Good morning, friends. Good morning, Lou. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm doing very well. Excited to get back into it here.
All right, good. So what we're going to do today, we're going to start with the where the Gita really starts, which is chapter 2 and verse 11 onwards. So most commentaries, actually, when they talk about the Gita, start with verse 11. Adi Shankaracharya is a person who did a commentary on the Gita after about 400, 500 years AD. And his Gita starts after this point. Hmm. So he eliminates the first chapter and the first few verses of chapter 2. Mm-hmm. But if you go back to our first sessions, we did cover a lot of the first chapter and even the first few verses of chapter 2, which basically are setting the stage. And the stage basically is, for those of you who might just be joining us, that Arjuna is a very well-decorated warrior. In those days, going back 5,000 years ago, if you were a warrior, that's all you did. Mm. You fought. Yeah. It was like your religion, that if you were a warrior, you did not back away from a war. Now, in this particular war in the Mahabharata, Arjuna had tried to negotiate with the people that he's going to war with, who happened to be his cousins and relatives and friends and so on. They were very unrighteous people, very, very. It's a long story in the Mahabharata. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we don't want to go into all of that. But he tried his best to negotiate with them and to plead with them. And no matter what he did, they were just essentially telling him to go jump in the lake. And nothing was working with them. So he had no choice, and he planned for 13 years to go to war with them, trained himself in the jungles and his brothers. And when they were at the battlefront, he, not being afraid of being killed or hurt, it was not fear. It was basically feeling like, I don't want to kill these people that I've known my whole life. I'd rather be named a coward, which was worse than death in those days. To be called a coward was the worst possible instinct, worst possible end result. And so he said, I'd rather be called a coward than have to suffer the consequences of killing these people. So that's the backdrop up to now. And this over here starts to say, you know, what exactly is death? Because basically what Arjun's saying is, I don't want to kill these people. I don't want them to die. And so Gita starts off with what is death? And what happens to a person after death? What is life all about? Some things that most of us struggle with if one is of philosophical bent. Sure. So verse 9, Sanjay is reporting to the king as to what's happening in the battlefront. And Arjuna says to Krishna, I will not fight. And he sits down silently. That's verse 9. Verse 10, Krishna spoke these words that he was not at all moved by Arjuna's cries. And as if smiling, he answered the following verses. So that's verse 10.
Right.
So there's nothing in that to explain. Essentially, just to say that Krishna was not moved by all of everything that Arjuna was saying. In verse 11, now here's where it starts. It says, the words are, the wise grieve neither for the living nor for the dead. So in the Sanskrit word for dead is gatasun. Gatasun means whose breath has gone. Hmm. They don't call it dead. Right. They say the person whose breath has gone. And agatasun means living, but really it says whose breath has not yet gone.
Oh.
So he's saying that all of us are going to die. It's just that these people, their breath has already gone, and these people, their breath has not yet gone, but will go sometime. So the wise grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. So what exactly does that mean? Who are the wise? The wise are, in Sanskrit, he refers to them as the pundits. A pundit is an expert in something, yeah. A scholar, a religious scholar, and one who has enlightenment about the truth, knowledge about oneself. That's who a pundit is. That pundit, that scholar, does not grieve for either the living or the dead. So the central teaching here is know yourself. Know yourself, know what you are. And by knowing this, you know, what am I? So this text, as it starts, it's important to know that we are essentially a part of Brahman. We talked about this in previous things, so I won't go into it in detail.
Right.
But the larger Brahman gives us a little bit of life, the same amount to every human being, every animal, every plant, every tree. And the Brahman is everywhere. So the analogy, I think I gave this already, but I'll talk about it again, is that of, assume that I'm a small little wave, small little ripple of a wave in the big Atlantic or Pacific Ocean, Indian Ocean. And I'm going along in the ocean pretty happy. I've got my buddies. I'm playing with them. And I say, wow, I'm great. Look at me. Then I look behind me and I see a much bigger wave. Uh-oh. And I feel jealous. I say, how come he's so much bigger? Then in front of me, I see a little wave. I say, oh, I'm arrogant. I say, oh, he's smaller than me, but I'm still a wave. And behind that bigger wave is the huge, big ocean of Brahma. And as we start coming closer and closer to the shore where there are rocks, I say to my buddies, what's all that foam and those waves crashing over there? And the buddy says, oh, that's where we all crash against the rocks and we all die.
Uh-oh.
And I say, what? We die? He said, yeah, we all die. We all go towards the rocks and we crash against them and then we die. And he says, but I don't want to die. And my buddy says, well, you're not going to die. I mean, the wave that you are right now, even that big guy behind us, that big wave is going to crash against those rocks and then we'll just merge back into the ocean. We'll be seawater again and then you'll merge back and you'll come back as another wave. All the jealousy, all the envy, all the anger, all the stuck-upness, all goes away when you realize that you are just the same as everybody else. You're just ocean water, just like the big wave that was behind you or the small wave that's in front of you. You are just ocean water. So this is what this wave, this chapter, this verse is looking to convey to us, that essentially all of us, who are we? We are the Atman inside us. We are not Lou or anybody else. We are the Atman functioning with a body around us. So when we leave our body, that body is necessary for us to conduct ourselves, to conduct our lives, to walk around. And when that body is no longer able to fulfill our vasanas, our desires, then is when the Atman says, okay, I need a different body. So it sheds that first body and then goes on to the next, as you see in future chapters. You are not the body. I am not the body. What you are really is the one that's inside the body.
Mm-hmm.
That's eternal, the one with the capital O. That's forever. So assume that I am talking to my friend on the phone, and that person is talking to me on the phone, and all of a sudden, my battery dies.
Yes.
Right? My friend says, oh, I was just talking to my friend, and now I can't hear him anymore. Why? Because my body, with which I was communicating to him, my phone, my iPhone, died.
Right.
So I can't communicate. And I have to get a new phone, but the new phone doesn't have his phone number anymore. So I can't communicate with him. So he says, well, you know, now that he's lost his phone and lost all his data, he can't communicate with me. So that's exactly what happens with the Atman. The Atman dies or passes on, takes on a new body, maintains everything else that it has. It moves the subtle body along with it. So the mind, the intellect, the memory, all of these things, to some extent, it's like curled up in deep sleep. You go into the next body, some vestige of those things are still there in that second body. But although there are many reports of people who come into a new life, a new body, who have memories of their previous life, and there's books on this, they remember exactly where they came from, what their previous life was, and that they've been reincarnated, but the majority of us don't. So it's like that telephone that you got a new iPhone, you got a new body, but all the previous contacts have been deleted. Yes. So you can't go back and meet up with your old buddies and stuff like that. So why do we have religion or spirituality then, if this is the case? And that is because most of us are afflicted what the scriptures call the threefold sorrow. And these scriptures help us to get rid of that threefold sorrow. So what is a threefold sorrow? And this was written many thousands of years ago, and it was actually found in a Chinese translation sometime around 100 AD. And this translation said that this had been picked up from the Sanskrit a few thousand years before that. That Chinese translation says the threefold sorrow is, number one, your body, mind, and intellect. You know, body yes. has sorrow because you get sick. Mm-hmm. Mind has sorrow because your loved one doesn't love you anymore or whatever emotions. And the intellect says, I didn't get this honor, I wasn't elected chairman, whatever, so you're sorrowful because of that. The second fold of the sorrow is other beings. In those days, thousands of years ago, they meant wild animals around there. You were sorrowful because you got attacked by a lion or a tiger or whatever. And the third was the nature, the elements, heat, cold, hurricanes, earthquakes. So those were the threefold sorrow. Now, what they found at that time was that there was no worldly solution to any of this. So, for instance, there is, but those cures, those solutions are not permanent and they're not certain. There's some doubt to it. So, for instance, if you said, well, I'm ill, I have some kind of a disease that's hurting me, that's a sorrow because it affects your body.
Right.
You go to the doctor, and he says, oh, I got treatment for this. I'll give you an antibiotic. And he does. You take the antibiotic, but then there's a fear of some other illness coming about. So there's no permanent or certain cure for this, or as there isn't for animals or the outside or any kind of earthquakes. So now we move on to chapter 12. And I want to go quickly because we need to do chapter 12, 13, 14, and 15.
Right.
So in verse 12, it says, never indeed was I not. This is Krishna talking, mm-hmm. who is a self-realized person, essentially Atman. Never indeed was I not, nor you, nor these rulers of men. Also, none of us will cease to be hereafter. So it's a negative. Instead of saying, I was always there,
yeah,
and so were you, and so were these kings and rulers of men, he says, never indeed was I not here. Mm-hmm. Also, none of us will cease to be hereafter, meaning we'll always be here. What he's referring to is not the mind, body, and intellect of ourselves, but our Atman. Our right. Atman will always be there. It gives us life, and it never dies. It exists eternally. It existed in the past. It existed in the present, and will exist in the future. This is the hallmark of the Gita. This is basically what it wants to teach us, that we are our Atman. Now, as a child, we say, I am a child. I'm a little boy. I'm a little girl.
Right.
Then you get to be a young man. You say, I'm a young man. I'm an adult. I'm an old man. And you keep saying, I am. The body changes, the mind changes, the intellect changes, but the only thing that remains constant is the I, which is the real I, which is the Atman. That's constant. You go to sleep, and in the sleep, you're dreaming that you're somebody else. You dream that you're Julius Caesar.
Yes.
When you wake up, you say, I'm Mr. Brown.
Tom Brady. I dream of Tom Brady.
Tom Brady.
Yeah.
When you're in deep sleep, when you wake up, you say, I was in nothingness. I don't remember anything. I was so fast asleep. So I am nothing. So you're Tom Brady, you're Mr. Brown, you are nothing. But throughout all of that, whether it be waking or dreaming or deep sleep, you are the Atman. Mm-hmm. That is constant. That is to be remembered. The story that the scriptures tell is of a king who was King Janaka. He's extremely, we mentioned him in previous sessions, extremely wealthy, extremely powerful king, who was fast asleep in his chamber with guards all around the his bedroom chamber. And in his sleep, he had a deep dream, which seemed very real to him, that he was actually so hungry, so poor. He had no money, he was no clothes, he was being pushed around in the bazaar, and he was going around begging. And he woke up and he saw that he was not a beggar, but he was really still the king, lying in his bed, but he was panicking. And he said, that dream seemed so real to me that I was a beggar. And now it seems so real to me that I'm sitting in the bed and I'm the king, and now I feel reassured. Which one is the real dream?
Right, yeah.
Was the dream real or this real? So he says, he calls the wise people from his outside and says, am I King Janaka who dreamed that I was a beggar? Or am I a beggar now dreaming that I am king? And all of them say, well, I don't know how to answer this question. They couldn't. So they called a real wise person, Ashtavakra, and he said, you are neither the beggar nor the king. You are the self with a capital S. So that really is where this whole thing is leading up to. So in verse 13, it says, just as the embodied being meaning the Atman,
right,
passes through childhood, youth, and old age in this body, so does it pass into another body. There, the wise one is not grieved. That's the 13th verse. So basically, it means exactly what we said, that the embodied Atman is housed within the body and the intellect and the mind, goes through life, goes through childhood, goes through adulthood, goes through old age, and then when the body can no longer serve, just like a clothes or car no longer can serve, it basically passes into another body. So it's just got a brand new body instead of an older one.
Right.
So the wise one, the pundits, don't grieve such a passage. And the verse 14 says that the sense contacts which cause heat, cold, pleasure, pain, they come and go. They are impermanent. Endure them. In here, the sense contacts are called matra, and the sense objects are called sparsha. Matra, ma means measure or to know, and that by which you know those things. So the eyes contact things that are appealing to it, colorful. The ears listen to the sound, and so on. So there's heat and cold for the body, pleasure and pain, honor and dishonor for the intellect, success and failure also for the intellect and the mind. And these come and go. Neither one of a pair of opposites is permanent. If you go up one time, you're going to go down next time. No experience that the person has is permanent. Deal with each, whether it's up or down, understanding that it is impermanent. It is an inevitable part of life, and you say to yourself, even this shall pass away. So deal with it, put up with it, ask yourself why or why not. And the last verse, which is verse 15, says, the man who these do not afflict, which is the opposites, pleasure, pain, etc.,
right,
is balanced in pain and pleasure. Whether he has pain or pleasure, he's the same. He's serene. He is fit for immortality. Immortality does not mean essentially that he's not going to die. It basically means that he will continue to go on his pursuit towards reaching the self and becoming self-realized. So I'm trying to keep these sessions to about 30 minutes. I'm assuming we're close to that right now.
Well, we're about 20, yeah.
Yeah. So the verse 16 is probably one of the highest known verses in the Gita, one of the deepest. And so I'm going to stop here and ask that our viewers, now that we are getting into some really weighty philosophical material in the Gita that if you have questions, comments, suggestions, requests, anything, just put them down on the Facebook page. Lou will tell you how to do that, and I'll be happy to respond as quickly as I can. So thank you very much for joining us, and I'll see you next time.